Well, here we are, the first Sunday of the Christian year. And the first thing we're told to do in the season of Advent is to wait. Indeed, waiting is part of the definition of the word itself. We're waiting for the coming. But what are we waiting for, really? If Jesus has already come, what are we waiting for? Is it just that restless yearning for things to get better? That insatiable desire we humans have for, well, more security, more safety, more satisfaction? Or is this the kind of waiting that complains and gripes about our society, about the state of affairs, maybe personally? Man, I wish I could get through this illness. Or something larger, something more societal. When will we get a different political leader? All we can do is wait for something better, I guess. Well, in contrast to those common understandings, those common experiences of waiting, Advent is the season bequeathed, given to us, if you will, by the great tradition in which we are given the space to learn again, to continue learning what it means to wait for the Lord, to hear the words of promise, the summons to prepare ourselves for the Lord's appearing, and to discern the difference between those things that seem to amuse us or distract us, those things that are clamored after, those things we gripe about, and those things, often small things, which genuinely begin to work away on us as we learn to wait on the Lord, as we learn, particularly on Advent 1, to hope for God's appearing. Now, after our second reading, we continue our reflections. They shall beat their swords into plowshares, neither shall they learn war anymore. Really? More like sentimental claptrap, isn't it? Nothing exposes the difference between mere human optimism and deeply biblical hope than looking at the dream of a warless world. The dream, actually, of neighbors, living with neighbors in peace. The dream of not just one or two or three nations flourishing, but all the nations of the earth flourishing, as together we base our political wisdom on divine teaching. Both optimism and genuine hope seem, at the beginning, to expect positive developments in the future. But as the famous theologian Jürgen Moltmann has argued, they are in fact radically different perspectives on reality. Optimism is based on cause and effect thinking, and we extrapolate out from that. We draw conclusions about the future based on experiences from our past and present. Since my sons seemed to take to reading at a young age, I could legitimately be optimistic that they would continue to read once they were at school. But sometimes we're extrapolating wrongly from our optimism, if you will. We're optimistic based on the slimmest pieces of evidence. If, for example, I would have thought my son is good at climbing things on the playground as a youngster, which he was, therefore he's going to become a world-famous mountaineer and explorer, my optimism, of course, would have been misplaced. When I worked on the prairies, I'd meet families who sometimes genuinely thought that their son, the star of the midget hockey team, would one day become an NHL star. I didn't have the heart to tell them to craft a better retirement plan. Now, don't get me wrong, the future will largely turn out to be the result of the causes, both past and present. Both good and bad will result from what has transpired in our past and in our present. I'm optimistic, for instance, that my growing wisdom, based on my experiences, will make a difference to my happiness as I get older. That's my optimistic side. But I'm also realistic. My bones and body are slowly breaking down, and I'm right to plan accordingly. But hope is different. Now, not the word hope, which is merely a synonym for optimism in our common use of that in the English language today, but the theme, the ideas behind biblical hope, which are not based on our experiences. Genuine biblical hope is not based on whether we're feeling optimistic or pessimistic. It's not based on the possibilities, if you will, in our individual and corporate situations. Hope is independent of our present circumstances, whether that be good or bad. Because hope, as we sing in our hymns today, as we read in our scriptures, is grounded in the faithfulness of God. Hope, then, is based on God's possibilities, irrespective of ours. This means that hope can spring up even in the shadow and the presence of evil, in the shadow and presence of violence. When the author of our first reading was alive, the prophet Isaiah, the northern kingdom of Israel was toast, and I'm not even using that metaphorically. It was burnt, it was slaughtered, quartered, and consumed by Assyria. There was no human reason for optimism. There was no martial plan that was going to come and rebuild the northern Israelite society. There was no United Nations looking out for their plight. No human possibility. And yet, precisely because of this, if you will, God's possibilities, God's promises, could now be highlighted in a way that they hadn't been before. From the perspective of human optimism, nothing could have been more absurd than asserting that Jerusalem would somehow become the center of the world's wisdom, that an obscure kingdom of sheep herders, now being led away in chains, presumably never to be heard from again, would in time not only regain their place, but now witness the pilgrimage of nations towards them. It's like life coming precisely because something is dead. Wait, that's a thing, isn't it? That's something you and I recognize in our stories. The God who created the universe, who freed Israel from Egypt, from slavery, who raised Jesus from the dead. The possibilities resident in this God can generate light in the midst of sheer darkness. What passes for hope in our world, particularly in our Western world, has very little to do with the God revealed in Jesus. We're drawn to public figures who spout platitudes and optimism because on a surface level, they make us feel good. Now, don't get me wrong. Optimism and sunny ways, just to riff on one of the ways our Prime Minister has been described, is not a bad thing. We have to have optimism in our society for our social gatherings and for our decision making to work well. Nobody wants to come around somebody who is constantly negative and pessimistic. So there is a place for optimism. The problem is if it's just optimism, this tastes good at the beginning. It's like an elixir which tastes sweet. But then when we look at what's actually happening in our society, we take a long view. We look at things more realistically, if you will. We realize that we're not being told the truth, and the drink turns to dregs and turns bitter in our mouth. Optimism thrives on the surface of things, but often it's an avoidance technique. It thrives within the context of youthful exuberance, strength, the endorphin rush that comes when something works out, when a project is completed, when our budget is balanced, when that holiday on the beach is everything we hoped for and we hear the Merry Christmas on a cold winter's night. Nothing bad with any of those things, but they're all fleeting. Optimism will inevitably crash into the hard rock wall of reality. To quote the second president of the United States, John Adams, facts are stubborn things. Reality is a stubborn thing. And of course, never have we needed to understand this as much as we do today. But what is less reckoned with is that we don't usually want to face reality, to face facts. The facts of our life, of our age, of our diminishment. We can, however, gain courage to do so when we begin to reckon with God, the God who brings life from death. And now we come to our third and final reflection on this first Sunday of Advent. And it's a reflection based on the three readings as a whole. The path from optimism to genuine hope is in many ways the paradoxical journey of recognizing the hopelessness of our world. At least it begins there. And if I can say something fairly controversial, maybe not as controversial as it would have once been, but still kind of jars us. Even the hopelessness of Christianity. Because though there are many wonderful things that have arisen from our faith, many social advances, many beautiful things that have happened for the poor of the earth through the service and sainthood of people who have followed Jesus. Christianity as a whole, as a system, has participated in many of the things that have furthered injustice and violence in our world. And so it doesn't matter really what time you've lived, what place you've lived, what religion you've adhered to. We understand that the earth has a problem, and humans are it. But, now in Advent, we can also say the next thing. The earth has a future that can arise from genuine hope, and humans, partnering with God, are a huge part of making that possibility happen, the earth having a positive future. The Bible holds on to both of these things at the same time. And as the Anglican bishop and New Testament scholar N.T. Wright says, our gospel text is about what it means to live and work in our world when we take both of those realities, that humans are the problem and that humans are partnering with God are the solution, when we take those things together and when we recognize that human effort is not enough to make that happen. Just so, we wait. We wait for the Lord. Which, if we go back to our second reading in Romans 13, is defined by Paul not passively, but as the massive, if you will, life-consuming effort of waking up, of becoming aware, of what it means to wait for the Lord's work, for the Lord's revelation. What it means to partner with the Lord, and how deadening our own efforts on their own really are, even the efforts of feel-good optimism, if you will. If I can paraphrase Noam Chomsky, who I don't always agree with, and that's probably an understatement, But I agree with him here. Feel-good American optimism has led us straight into the teeth of empire and all the worst aspects of empire. But you and I, those of us who claim to follow Jesus, are again this Advent season called to wake up, to put on the Lord Jesus Christ, and to make no provision for the flesh, which is really this idea of merely surfacey desires that won't satisfy us, but will merely work to oppress others and rape the earth. And in our gospel reading, this waiting, this waking up, is described by Jesus as a kind of watchfulness. This passage has been taken out of all kinds of theological and metaphorical contexts and taken literally, but you know, it really is about that. It's about a stance of living. And it's Noah's patient activity of building the ark in the midst of a decadent culture that is the icon, if you will, of what Jesus is talking about here. And in the early church, Noah's labor was seen as a metaphor for building up God's people, the church. And in many of our neo-Gothic churches, we can look up at the roof and we see the bottom of the ark, if you will. The ship that is being built by the people of God. Given what the Lord had told Noah, he certainly couldn't have been optimistic about human culture, human society. The Lord said to him he was going to destroy everybody. He was going to wipe everyone out because of their wickedness. But the actions of his ordinary daily life over many, many years, even in the face of opposition, was a fruit of the hope that was birthed in him by the revelation God gave him, and ended up, of course, being the salvation not only of his family, but of the natural world. Surely Noah, in some strange way, can be our patron saint again in our time of environmental stress and emergency, when the very future of our earth is in question. And surely Noah and Paul demonstrate for us that genuine hope works from the deep character transformation that happens when we seek to be obedient to the Lord in the midst of difficulties, in the midst of pressure. Genuine hope, then, is not an idea. It's not a feeling, but comes from participating with God in the difficult task of building the church and participating in its mission. Participating in its mission as the church itself participates with God's mission to bring hope and healing to the world. When we look at ourselves and the smallness of our efforts, to imagine them mattering can seem as ludicrous as Isaiah's vision. But as we take up the tasks, one by one, the call to prayer, the participation in the community, taking our share of service, leadership, and indeed the joys and real pain of working together in our incomplete ways, optimism starts to be replaced. Mere optimism starts to be put aside, and genuine hope begins to birth in our hearts. Genuine hope in the Lord's presence and promise begins to take hold in us. And God's hope, even as it ends up leading us through some very dangerous places, through the valley of the shadow of death, if you will always come out upon that beautiful mountain where we learn war no more. Amen.